welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and we are recording this week from Frank's brand new office on the 10th floor of the David Hume Tower. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great. We're live from David Hume Tower, which is we're hoping it's a better room to record in. We will see, but we have a great view, if nothing else.
But for local people, you can come. Can people come visit you here, Frank? Friendly people can come visit Frank because he has a much better view in this office than we have in our old offices, or my old office. Yes.
That's absolutely true. So, yeah, come and see me on the 10th floor, room 1014 in David Hume Tower. And one of the things is, as local people will know, David Hume Tower might be the ugliest building at the university, but one of the virtues of being inside it is I don't look at it. So I'm looking out at an amazing view of Arthur's Seat, as you can see in Salisbury Crags.
Yes.
But I am not looking at David Hume Tower, which is also a benefit.
Wasn't there a French writer who said the same thing about the Eiffel Tower, that he'd like to go there so he could not see the Eiffel Tower?
I don't know.
So earlier this week, President Trump announced that he was ordering a ban on certain kinds of vaping technologies, especially those that have flavors, after there were 6 reported deaths and some 400 cases of health issues related to vaping. And so what we thought we would do today is talk about the history of tobacco use in the United States, the history of the ways in which technology is involved in tobacco, and government regulation. Before we get all that, Frank, have you ever vaped?
I have not. I'll give you my views on vaping in a second. David, have you vaped?
I have not vaped.
Right.
And are you, have you, you're not a smoker?
I am not a smoker. I am the child of smokers. I grew up around a lot of secondhand smoke, which I hated. I am not a smoker. And one of the changes that really improved life in Scotland, as far from my perspective, was I should have looked this up before we started. It must be 20 years ago when they actually banned smoking indoors. And so there was no more smoking in pubs, for example, and that really improved things. So I am the wrong person to be talking about this week.
The fact that we are, in and amongst people who are smoking, I think, and benefited from these bans, I think it makes us just as good as anybody to talk about
it. I suppose, although one of the things that I think will become clear, I think smoking has increasingly become really a class-based activity. And so I don't see as much smoking among middle-class academics now, at conferences, for example,
sure,
as one used to see 20, 25 years ago. That's anecdotal. You're giving me a crystal look.
I think there are actually lots of people who smoke who don't do it as publicly as they did or might have done 20 years ago.
So why is that? Is there a stigma attached to
that? Well, I think that it used to be that smoking was something that one could do and there wasn't a stigma attached to it. And I think now people, because there is a stigma attached to, especially cigarette smoking. President Obama smoked for much of the years that he was in the White House, but you never saw a picture of him with a cigarette in his mouth.
No, in that he echoed his fictional counterpart Jed Bartlett from The West Wing, who was also a closet smoker. Would smoke surreptitiously in The West Wing, and Obama was a surreptitious smoker.
Yeah, and I think he was doing that partially because he didn't want to be a role model for people and make it sort of justify other people's starting.
But in answer to your question about vaping,
yes.
No, I have not vaped, and I think you and I might have a slight difference of opinion on this because you're down with the kids and I'm not. one of the contrasts between vaping and cigarettes, it seems to me, is cigarettes. If you look at, if you watch film noir from the 40s, right?
Okay.
Or you put on Casablanca, when Bogey lights a cigarette, you think, wow, that looks cool, right? Vaping does not look cool. When you see people walking down the street vaping, they look like idiots. I'm sorry. I'm going to take a stand on this. Vaping is not a cool activity or a cool appearing activity. And I think that's a problem for vaping. You're, again, giving me a physical look.
So, I mean, I would agree with you that there was a period of time in which smoking was deeply romanticized in American culture and in global Western culture. But I think for young people, vaping can be as cool as cigarette smoking was in the 1940s. You're not the target audience for the Juul.
Indeed, I am not. And David, nor are you.
This is a fair point.
But actually, you've got kids younger than mine. So do their friends vape?
I don't think so, but I also don't know.
Right.
I think one of the things that part of the reason why vaping has become popular in part is I think you can do it clandestinely more easily than you can smoke cigarettes necessarily.
Yeah, if you come home having smoked.
Or if you're in an apartment where smoking is not allowed, vaping, I think, because it actually doesn't involve combustion in the same way, can be done in a more clandestine manner. So I think that's part of the appeal for teenagers. Plus, it doesn't actually look like cigarettes, so their parents may not know what the thing is. It looks like a flash drive.
Yeah, or that you're sucking on a kazoo. but anyway.
Right, so let's take this back a little bit. So, tobacco has been deeply important in the history of the United States and its development. I mean, your man Jefferson, was, among other things, a tobacco farmer. You got your George Washington socks on there. He was a tobacco farmer. Tobacco in some ways is as deeply rooted in the origins of English and British North America. What was so important about tobacco?
Well, this resonates with something we discussed in passing a couple of weeks ago, which is the 1619 Project from the New York Times.
Sure.
The 1619 Project marks the advent of the arrival of enslaved people in English, latterly British North America, of course. Why were they arriving? Why was there a market for enslaved people? Why was there a market for unfree labor in early America, particularly in Virginia? There was a and Maryland. There was a market because of tobacco. I mean, the reason the Virginia colonies established in 1607, and it's a disaster. It nearly fades. The people there nearly starve. In fact, they do starve in the early years.
They're engaged in cannibalism.
Well, one or two incidents, and now that's all anybody ever talks about. But yes, there's a little bit of cannibalism. They have all kinds of problems in the early days. And then in 1612, they begin cultivating tobacco. And suddenly that colony looks profitable and starts to turn a profit. And the market for tobacco takes off in the 17th century, the market for tobacco in Europe.
Yeah.
Not just in Britain, but also in mainland Europe. And Virginia and Maryland and latterly North Carolina are ideal places to cultivate tobacco. And the so-called first families of Virginia, those great aristocratic families of the 18th century, their wealth is derived from the cultivation of tobacco. So the importance of tobacco to the development of British North America is very difficult to overstate. Put another way, of the mainland colonies, the ones that are valuable are the ones that are producing tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
New England isn't important. What do they produce? Religious bigots. Virginia is producing a staple crop that generates huge income for the people who raise it, for the people who market it and sell it in Europe, taxes for the crown. It's an incredibly important staple crop. It's the one thing that makes Virginia approach the so-called sugar colonies in the Caribbean in value to Britain. Mainland North America is not that important during the 17th century. It's those colonies that are producing sugar in the Caribbean and tobacco in mainland North America that matter.
Well, one of the interesting things, bringing it to 1619, I believe the person who records the arrival of the first enslaved people is John Rolfe, who is the same person who introduces tobacco into Virginia. Or I should say, he introduces the variety of tobacco into Virginia that then becomes the profitable one. There was a local indigenous kind of tobacco the Native Americans smoked, and the English settlers tried it and they didn't like it. The kind that actually sort of took off and created the sort of tobacco boom actually came from, I believe, Brazil? Came from somewhere in South America, the variety of it.
Yeah, they call it Spanish tobacco.
Tobacco or Orinoco tobacco. And John Rolfe is famous for I guess three things. One is recording the first enslaved people arriving. The second is for introducing tobacco, which made the colony profitable. Frank, you want to tell everyone the third thing?
He also married Pocahontas.
Yeah. So as opposed to Disney.
Married. I'm using married. I'm qualifying married here. I'm using my air quotes here, listeners.
Really brought her back to England and introduced her to the Queen.
She died.
Well, yes. to be sure. So,
but John Rolfe is, and in fact, you're quite right, David. John Rolfe was a pivotal figure in the history of early Virginia, and the three things he's famous for actually are all interrelated, frankly.
Mm.
So, the colony, the colony is made possible by the displacement of indigenous people, the marriage, such as it was, and we don't know all the details, with his marriage with Pocahontas might have been a diplomatic settlement, as a result of a diplomatic settlement, but they need that land. Why do they need land? They need land because they're raising tobacco. They're raising tobacco because it's profitable, and tobacco is a very labor-intensive crop. And eventually, they will, in the 17th century, rely primarily on indentured servants, mainly from the British Isles, for their labor. But they will make a gradual transition to enslaved African labor over the course of the 17th century, and really jump in with both feet in the 18th century. But this is all about tobacco.
So what are they using the tobacco in the 17th and 18th century? What are they using it for? What are the modes of delivery?
Well, I thought you were going to go in a slightly different direction. One of the things they use it for in Virginia is currency. It's so valuable.
Sure, yeah.
So they actually trade tobacco certificates, in some cases literally trade tobacco. But in terms of the modes of delivery, they're smoking it in pipes and they're chewing it. And again, Virginians are doing this, but really the market is in Europe for it.
And
let's not forget, it's a highly addictive substance.
Nicotine. And in case anyone thinks that they were ignorant entirely about the fact that this stuff is bad for you, James I/VI, I guess we're in Scotland, so we should say the sixth.
So sixth and first.
Is we're going to prioritize the because I guess he was king of Scotland first. Yes. Anyway, the guy, Jimmy, who was born down the street here, famously said not long after the sort of beginning of the Virginia tobacco boom that he thought it was a noxious weed or something, and thought it was awful that people were doing this. But then he saw how much money he was making from it, and I think he, demurred in his criticism.
Gone with the program.
Exactly. He's like, well, I can buy some castles or something. Anyway, for those people who are London-based listeners, if you want to find evidence, by the way, of this tobacco addiction and delivery modes, one of the things you can do on the banks of the Thames is you can find today discarded tobacco pipes. These were often sort of basically disposable pre-packed tobacco pipes made of clay, and that people would, when they're done smoking them, toss them in the river, and you can go and collect them now on the banks when it's, I guess, the river is low. And I've done that before. You ever done that? Mudlarking?
I have not done mudlarking.
Oh, it's good. It's a good fun,
Have you done it in London?
Yeah, yeah. You can't dig, but if there's stuff that sort of washes up every day, and you'll see, like, oh, this is from... And you can, people who are knowledgeable about this stuff can point out, say, oh, that's a pipe stem from 1760, and that one's from 1820 or whatever it is.
So where in, sorry, I don't want to distract too much, but where in London can
one do this? So there's a couple places. The place where I went was just opposite the Tate Modern. There's that bridge that goes across. There's a little path down to basically the riverbank. And, there's maybe 20 feet wide of beach, I guess, essentially. It's dirt and whatnot, but there are pottery fragments that sort of wash up, and people go down there and they find all kinds of things. It's great fun.
And are you allowed to keep what you get?
So
is this monitored in any way?
They're picking up garbage from from the 18th century.
So does somebody organize mudlarking expeditions?
You just go, and there's like certain times of day when the river's lower, and so you go then. And then people look down at you, from the bridge up, and they're off to their fancy jobs and look at you like you're doing something kind of strange. But yeah, you find sort of both the stems and the pipe bowls and fragments of European pottery and all kinds of nifty stuff. It's good times.
Okay.
All which
Ladies
is
and gentlemen, say, mudlarking with David Silvanat. The Mudlarker podcast.
I'm sure there is one. There's a podcast. No,
fascinating. Sorry, I was the one who explained. Anyway, thank you, David.
So the two sort of main modes of delivery, in the 17th and 18th century were chewing tobacco and pipe tobacco. It's not really until we get into the sort of mid and late 19th century that we get the sort of modern version of the cigarette coming into place.
And sorry, one thing to say, and I know our listeners who are historians will be aware of this, but for those who aren't, there's always a confusion, one sees this with our students in particular, when you teach the period we teach,
yes,
about tobacco versus cotton and everything else. Yeah. And so sometimes students assume that cotton was always raised in North America when there was slavery. And of course, that wasn't true.
Except for in the Sea Islands.
Right.
Yeah.
But as the main staple crop. Tobacco was the main staple crop, although Virginians in the late 18th century, the era of the Revolution, are making a move away from it, in part for economic reasons, because the price of tobacco was falling, and there were kind of macroeconomic reasons for that, but also for environmental reasons, because tobacco was exhausting, tobacco was depleting the land, and they were making a transition to from tobacco to wheat. So both Jefferson and Washington, for example, make that transition or attempt to make it.
And lots of people do. Right?
But tobacco cultivation never ceases. I mean, I'm looking at a guy who spent a lot of his life in North Carolina tobacco's. So just to give that picture before we move on to the
Century. So tobacco in the 17th and 18th century is sort of the most important export from English North America, British North America / the United States. And then in the 19th century, cotton really takes over as the dominant export, and then the 20th century becomes cars or something.
Yeah,
and part of the location of where people are growing tobacco actually has to do with the varieties of tobacco people are growing and the way that they're processed. And that actually connects with the development of cigarettes.
Take it away.
So there's two big things that really lead to the development of cigarettes. One is in the 1850s, the development of new techniques for curing tobacco. The way they were curing tobacco in the colonial period, in the early part of the 19th century, it leaves the leaf very dark and makes the tobacco good for chewing. It makes it bad for chewing because chewing tobacco kills you, but it makes it appropriate for chewing and for pipe smoking. They develop a technique that involves a cooler kind of smoke, flue-cured tobacco, which makes a very bright-colored leaf, and that makes it much better for smoking cigarettes. The big difference, my understanding, and I'm not a smoker, is that when you're smoking pipe tobacco, or when you're smoking cigars, you basically put the smoke in your mouth. When you're smoking a cigarette, you bring it into your lungs, and you want a different level of, acidity in the tobacco and what have you. So they developed this new technique for flue-curing tobacco, and it also allows tobacco to be produced in parts of, especially the Piedmont, where tobacco hadn't been profitable before, in terms of the ways in which the tobacco was grown. And so that was an important development. It really starts in the 1850s. The other important development in terms of changing the tobacco industry and the way that tobacco was both produced and used is the development of the Bonsack machine in 1880.
The Bonsack machine?
Bonsack machine is a machine for making cigarettes. So prior to that, if you wanted to smoke a cigarette, you had to roll your own. Actually, it's still a very common thing here in the UK.
That's really, when you see smokers outside of buildings here, they're often rolling their own cigarettes.
But if you wanted to sort of buy pre-made cigarettes, they would have to have been ones that were rolled by hand, which obviously is a very sort of labor-intensive, expensive process and would have added a great deal to the sort of price of a cigarette, much in the same way that like cigars are rolled by hand. It's an expensive, labor-intensive process. Well, the Bonsack machine basically made a machine that could roll cigarettes by the thousands. There's some, the early versions, I think, and I got some numbers here, could produce 200 cigarettes a minute, which, considering you roll cigarettes, like one cigarette per minute, this is much, much faster than that. And that allowed for industrialization on a scale.
So where was that invented,
It was invented in Virginia, and then it gets really put to full fruition by the American Tobacco Company, which is based in North Carolina. One of the families that makes a whole lot of money from the Bonsack machine and from the production of cigarettes is the Duke family, which some people may be familiar with because they go on to spend some money on a university and a basketball team. Those may be the same thing. I'm not quite sure. Right. Listeners, well, some listeners may know I went my undergraduate degrees from Duke.
So you went to Duke and University of North Carolina. I want to get back to that. But
okay, yes.
Put David on the couch here and his relationship with tobacco.
Okay. there's some wonderful... Anyway, tobacco has been very important in my education. But one of the things that does then is it sort of allows for a kind of production, industrial production of tobacco on a level that hadn't been before. And allows for, you know, a product that can be not only sort of mass produced, but can be sold much more cheaply and can be marketed to different audiences. It was very hard to market cigars and pipes, for instance, to women, whereas you can market cigarettes to women. In fact, initially cigarettes were kind of gendered as female, and they actually had to work marketing-wise to then market cigarettes to men as being an appropriately masculine device too. So the sort of industrial kind of tobacco production in some ways starts in the late 19th century and then sort of takes off from there. And you see these sort of enormous, you know, factories being built, especially in places like Durham, North Carolina, and in Charlotte, and in Winston-Salem, and all these places, especially in the North Carolina Piedmont, that become the major sort of production centers for tobacco. And they really become, by the early part of the 20th century, sort of a mainstream part of American society. They're so important that during the First World War that they start to introduce cigarettes as part of the regular rations that soldiers get. Black Jack Pershing supposedly said that he thought that cigarettes were as important to his soldiers as bullets and food were, which I think says something about the sort of the cultural and cultural importance of cigarettes by the early part of the 20th century.
Well, and they advertising played a big part in that, didn't it? In terms of like promoting cigarettes to a broader public. Now that they're being mass produced,
yes,
advertising played a big role in that market.
And they're seen as an aid in some ways to being a productive worker, right? And so cigarettes and coffee become the ways in which a worker gets to produce more and more in an industrial age in which that kind of productivity is particularly valued.
Because there were some outrageous claims, weren't there, in early advertising about they'll help you grow, they'll help you breathe,
exactly.
All that sort of things.
I think the cigarette industry becomes increasingly aware that both their product is unhealthy and they need to sort of counter any of that by actively promoting cigarettes as a healthy product. So you have advertisements in the 1950s and 60s in which you have doctors recommending various brands of cigarette as being, the best choice for your health. Which, in retrospect is ludicrous, but I think that was an age in which, the authority of experts was particularly valued and prominent.
That along with, my earlier comments about the coolness of smoking or the apparent coolness of smoking, that was a big part of the marketing.
Oh, yeah. You had Ronald Reagan advertising cigarettes, on the same magazines you had doctors advertising, promoting cigarettes. And so there was a ways in which the tobacco industry and the cigarette industry in particular, really were able to create an image of what cigarette smoking meant, the kinds of iconography you get, whether it's the Marlboro Man, that's very prominent throughout much of the 20th century, or even later things like, Joe Cool and whatnot, where they're creating models about what tobacco means.
So, David, I got a couple of questions for you arising from your recent comments. One is, joking aside, when you think about institutions like the University of North Carolina or Duke, now those are institutions in a state where tobacco remains an incredibly important industry, but certainly was an incredibly important industry in the 20th century, particularly in the early 20th century. What's the kind of, as somebody who spent a lot of time there and is affiliated with those institutions, what's the attitude people have towards, is smoking banned on campus?
Oh, smoking is not only banned on campus, it's very, very hard to, smoking is not very common in North Carolina.
Right.
Smoking rates are, at least in my experience, lower there, and this is anecdotal rather than, you know.
Basically. But is that in Raleigh-Durham and the Research Triangle, well, in those, which is basically one of America's foremost university communities?
Probably so. I mean, I you know, that is where I have spent most of my time, but I do notice that smoking rates in some ways seem higher other places. You know, on UNC campus, there's like, just because of the way the rules are written, there's like one place on campus that's next to a flagpole where you can smoke. It's because it's about the distance from buildings and whatnot, about the rules, about where you can go. So they have like one particular location where the people who are still smoking, it doesn't seem like very many people go there. Obviously, these are both schools that have huge medical centers, and so, you know, they're deeply invested in, you know, health issues. Most of the tobacco infrastructure that used to be, you know, very prominent on the landscape has now been converted to other things. I used to work out in a Y, for instance, that was a former tobacco factory. A lot of those tobacco warehouses are now fairly upscale apartments now for people, because that's what, you know, they don't need.
Or places where they make artisanal gin.
I've been in a, not so much gin, but beer, yes.
Right, sure.
And actually, I've been to more than one of those. There's a good beer scene in the Triangle. Anyway.
So is there an ambivalence about this relationship with tobacco and their origins? Or is, I mean, to some extent, this is just a specific, localized version of the larger question about the relationship with enslaved labor for almost all institutions that existed in the 18th and 19th centuries. And not just in the South.
You know, the those two schools in particular, I think, have a fairly hostile towards tobacco. You do find some evidence on the campus. For instance, there are some Corinthian columns on Duke campus, on the East campus, that are the traditional Corinthian columns have acanthus leaves in them. But the ones on Duke campus have tobacco leaves on them, you know, and so there's sort of subtle nods. And obviously, you know, James B. Duke and other members of the Duke family were deeply involved in the tobacco industry, and their statues are on campus. And the Duke Homestead, which is one of the early places where you know the tobacco industry took off, is a nearby museum. But you know, the places are solidly non-smoking institutions in terms of their, you know.
They don't, what's the law in North Carolina on smoking in public, is it?
I'm pretty sure you can't smoke in public almost anywhere. I think it's, you know, like most places, you know, they've passed a series of laws starting in the 1990s. They are limiting smoking in restaurants and in workplaces and in other kinds of public accommodations. And now you've, at least within the Triangle area, you very rarely see anyone smoking anywhere, at least not in public.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So how does this all end up getting regulated, though? Because you know, we've talked about how it was so integral. And let's not forget, this is addictive,
yes,
as well. So, a bit like alcohol, it was also, it's just integral to American culture as that culture develops in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Yeah.
And regulation comes later. So what's the story of regulation?
You start to find some regulation about selling tobacco products to children in the 1890s. I think by then you had...
Oh, as early as that? So is that part of the
progressivism? Well, so I think it's part of progressivism. I think it's part of the, you know, you have later on things like the Pure Food and Drug Act and trying to make sure that, you know, the markets are regulated in a variety of ways. Also, that's connected with the development of, you know, cigarettes as an industry. You don't need to regulate, you know, cigar smoking to 12-year-olds, because there aren't that many 12-year-olds who are interested in cigar smoking. So I think that part of it has to do with this being a technological, in some ways it's similar to the story that's going on right now with vaping, right? You've got a new technology giving access to this product to a new audience, and then regulation comes, you know, several years afterwards.
Yeah, because if people are just rolling their own cigarettes, right, you can't really regulate that. I suppose you could try to stop the sale to...
But it'd be very hard to, right? In the same way. You know, one of the things that happens for most of the 20th century is not regulation, but actually active government support for the tobacco industry. You know, I mentioned earlier, they have the rations in the First World War. Cigarettes remained part of the official ration until 1975. And so until, you know, after the Vietnam War is over. And by 1975, you know, the medical community, I think, was keyed in the fact that cigarette smoking was not a good idea and that it had really serious health effects. But, you know, I think that sort of speaks to the government's active, you know, in if not endorsement, at least support of, I guess that's the distinction without a difference, of the tobacco industry. You know, during the Great Depression, government spends millions of dollars as part of the Agricultural Adjustment Act to support tobacco farmers, and that continues for many years thereafter. In terms of regulation, I think it's not really until you get into the 1990s, and it's very much at the state level that lots of places start to regulate tobacco. You know, you find it in, I mean, you probably remember, I guess we both remember this from our, you know, childhoods and young adulthoods, that, you know, there used to be, you could smoke everywhere. People were smoking in airplanes.
On planes was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And in restaurants and everywhere. Like, smoking was a ubiquitous phenomenon. And I remember going to restaurants and being deathly ill just because there's not a smoke in the room, just because there are these small enclosed spaces, you know. And then they introduced things like smoking sections in...
We had one in my high school.
Cool. You had a smoking section?
There was a smoking area where the burnouts used to go to smoke.
Okay.
But you know, the expectation was, okay, high school kids are going to smoke, so therefore we'll create a space for them to do it. This was a public high school, state school in Massachusetts, but there was a smoking area.
Now were they people there who were smoking under the age of 18?
I imagine most of them were.
Okay.
I mean, I wasn't a smoker, so I didn't use the smoking area.
Okay.
And it was outside. It was a school, of course, a high school. Cool. Of course,
they were just seniors. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it was just the, you know, because some people, of course, in high school, seniors in high school can be 18 or over, but not many.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we had a smoking area in my high school.
But you had smoking sections on airplanes, on the supposition that in a small enclosed tube in the sky, that the smoke will stay in one part of that smoke.
Right. I mean, it was crazy. It was always in the back.
Yes. As if that makes a difference. You start to find both, you know, individual businesses and then states and localities, you know, start to slowly regulate cigarettes, especially in, you know, consumption of them in the 1990s is really when you start to see it take off. But then, you know, more widespread bans don't happen until the early part of this century. I remember right after I moved to North Dakota, they were instituting a smoking ban in bars in North Dakota. And there was lots of pushback to it.
I mean, well, going outside in North Dakota to smoke in the wintertime is a big... You got to be majorly addicted to do
well,
that.
Well, so what they thought would happen, right, was they said, well, this is going to cause people to die because they will go outside and smoke. Or they will stop smoking. Or they will break the law. And it turns out they went outside and smoked, even when it was minus 20. Which I guess speaks to the addictive properties of this product. But I think part of that was sort of feeding into this idea that cigarette smoking is not only bad for the person who's making the choice to smoke the cigarette, but it's also bad for people who are around those people. So especially for people who are working in the service industry, if you're working as a wait person, or if you're working in a bar or something, that you're consuming a lot of smoke, even if you're not smoking. And so it's, you know, I think that was one of the arguments that was really conducive to helping these bans take place.
And again, I remember it here. I remember when it happened in Ireland. The shift was incredibly quick once it came.
Because people
said, oh, this will change, you know, it'll be terrible. And it was, first of all, again, from my perspective,
as a non-smoker,
it was a great improvement. But also, people adapted incredibly quickly to this.
Mm.
And there was a sort of phenomenon in the early aughts here about, you'd see stories in the press about couples that had met while they were smoking outside and things like this.
Yes.
So there was still a bit of romance in a different way attached to it. But people adjusted. Business in bars and pubs did not decline.
To be sure.
As a result of this, and arguably it's increased.
Yes. The amount of time I will spend in a pub is vastly increased by my ability to breathe in there.
Right.
You know, one of the things that connecting with this, the news story that we started off the episode with is the disappearance or the lack of availability of cigarettes is one of the things that sort of promoted the rise of e-cigarettes and vaping on the supposition that if you can't smoke in a particular place, you might be able to use these other devices to both either get you off of smoking. I think that was originally how these things were marketed, as a way to transition from smoking to not smoking, or as a way of fulfilling your nicotine addiction without, you know, violating the letter of the law with these prohibitions.
Right. So vaping, certainly as I remember when these things became prominent 6 or 7 years ago, it was originally presented as part of a program to quit smoking.
Well, that's still the way that the companies make them advertise, you know, market them. That's what their purpose is. Now, it also seems that they've developed new audiences of people who were not smokers before. It seems as if one out of about half of the people who are using vaping machines now are not people who were smoking first, but they actually began their use with these machines.
Is there any evidence? I mean, forgive the use of the term. Is vaping a gateway activity that leads to smoking for young people? Is there evidence of that? So, or is it just that they're vaping and vaping is bad enough?
I don't think we know enough about vaping yet.
Right.
I think part of it seems it's mostly an unregulated market, especially in the United States. There's a number of, you know, Juul seems to be the elephant in the room in terms of this, the market share, but there are lots of different products that have different, you know, strengths of you know, concentrations of tobacco of nicotine in them, and so I'm not quite sure. One of the things people are concerned about with this ban that's going into place now is that it will actually cause people to not use vaping and go to cigarettes, you know, and actually cause people to start smoking cigarettes because they have an addiction they need to maintain. You know, one of the interesting things about the rise of vaping, and particularly the recent health scare, is that it's also connected in some ways with the legalization of marijuana.
Yeah.
We're having this moment in the United States in which marijuana, which had been illegal for decades, has now become gradually legal in a variety of places, either on a medicinal or recreational basis. And at least the news reports I've seen that the six deaths, at least some of them, are connected not with people who are using vapes for nicotine consumption, but for cannabinoid consumption. And some of these products are not necessarily ones you buy in a store, but ones that get some other place. So it may not be with, they may be banning the wrong product. You know, I think they're targeting right now the flavored vaping products, which are, you know, I think they rightly suspect are being marketed at children, if not directly, at least indirectly.
Yeah, we seem to be heading in, I'm glad you mentioned that, in two different directions on this, because we're seeing a liberalization with a small L of mm-hmm. The laws on marijuana and cannabis consumption across the United States. I mean, it's in certain states, but one sense is that once it's enough states, it will
there'll be a critical mass.
There'll be a critical mass, and it'll be impossible to keep illegal. And even in states where it's still nominally illegal, police aren't enforcing laws on possession of marijuana.
There's very sort of decriminalization.
Pot's being decriminalized. At the same time that tobacco is being regulated to a greater extent, and this move against vaping would seem to be of a piece with that.
Yeah.
I want to...
Lots of states have increased the age of purchase from 18 to 21
right.
for tobacco products.
Right, which, again, I welcome. I think we should regulate tobacco, but it's an interesting paradox, let's say. One thing that... I want to play devil's advocate here and maybe take a slightly libertarian position where vaping is concerned. So you mentioned six deaths... And what was it, 400 or 450 people severely...
With severe health
problems. Yes. The United States is a nation of 330 million people. And, well, the deaths of anybody prematurely is to be regretted. This seems to me, one could argue, apart from looking stupid, it's not much of a problem. Especially in the context, so this is what President Trump has decided to regulate. Let's not forget that yesterday, I think it was, they started to remove restrictions on clean water, and environmental controls to guarantee clean water. It seemed to me that's a more important public health question than vaping.
Oh, to be sure. The number of people who are going to die as a consequence of environmental deregulation over the past 2 years is going to be orders of magnitude higher than the six people who are, you know, seem to be have vaping connected deaths. It reminds me of the reaction in 1982 when there were some contaminated Tylenol bottles in the Chicago area, and they sort of pulled Tylenol everywhere around the country. You know, I just remember like my parents throwing out our Tylenol.
All the safety seals we now get on almost everything is a result of that as well.
Right. You know, there was a very profound reaction to, I think that was also six people killed, including I think like three or four of them were in the same family that were using the same bottle of Tylenol. And I don't think they ever actually figured out who did that. I think they add strychnine or something to the bottle. Anyway, there are times in which the government responds, I think, to these public health crises because of the ways in which they're covered in the media.
The public response.
Right. So I think there's the past couple of weeks in particular, there has been a sort of response to these vaping illnesses, and the government therefore wants to look proactive in its response to it. And I think much in the same way as when the Tylenol scare, the government wanted to look responsive to it, and the Tylenol company likewise wanted to look like they were being a good corporate entity back then. When there are very often are other public health issues which don't generate nearly as much either attention or have as much of an effect. I mean, during the Tylenol crisis, that was the same time as the AIDS crisis was starting, and the government did nothing as a consequence of that, despite the fact that there were hundreds and thousands of deaths happening in 1982 during the AIDS crisis. Likewise, I think you're right. This might be a handful of cases that may not actually be representative, and they're using it actually for a much... Their response seems to be maybe disproportional, and they may not actually be banning the right products. That being said, I don't think they should be selling these things to kids, because nicotine's bad for you. But
there was a backlash in this country, or a move to ban so-called Alco-Pops.
Yes.
This happens periodically, because they were being marketed to high school kids in particular, and they taste like soda, and they're easy to drink, and everything else. And that's true. And it seems to me there are some echoes of that.
I think that's right. I think that's right, that there's the way to justify government intervention on these questions of personal consumption and a libertarian would say that people should have the choice to make on their own, is you say, well, it's protecting the children. I think that's the rhetorical argument.
Right, and we're all in favor of protecting children. The interesting thing is about vaping is there doesn't seem to be evidence, and I take your point that we simply don't have enough data yet about the consequences of vaping, but there doesn't seem to be evidence that secondhand vaping is a problem, and the way the secondhand smoke was and is a problem. So one reason that cigarette smoking needs to be regulated is to protect those of us who don't smoke.
Yeah.
Whereas the libertarian argument could be, well, if you choose to do this to yourself and you're an adult, that's your choice, especially in a climate when marijuana is freely available, when alcohol is freely available. There are other addictive substances and drugs that are available. But I think the difference with tobacco, or at least the smoking of tobacco, is that it affects other people adversely.
Sure.
There's no evidence as yet, or limited evidence, it seems to me, that vaping affects other people. They don't let you do it in enclosed spaces. I mean, the same regulations for smoking seem to apply to vaping, but I think if somebody's walking down the street vaping, it doesn't really affect you if you pass them.
Well, and I think there are lots of people who do vape when in enclosed spaces. If the person in the next office was vaping, I'm not sure you'd know they were vaping.
Right. But does it matter?
Well, I don't think we know yet. I think that's part of the reason why this is a sort of interesting moment to look at government regulation, is I think the status of the health consequences of vaping are unclear. In some ways, there's a parallel with tobacco. One of the arguments that the tobacco industry used, in the 70s and 80s, is they would say, look, we don't really know what the health effects of smoking are precisely. Now, that was a lie.
Right.
Turns out they did know, and the settlement that they signed in 1998 demonstrated that they knew how bad it was. But, their argument in public was that we're not sure how bad it is, and therefore we shouldn't do anything. If you look at the early cigarette warning labels that were introduced in the United States, they all said this product may cause lung cancer, as opposed to this product does cause lung cancer, right. Which is the offers some kind of justification and wiggle room inside it. One of the things that's different between the United States and Europe is, and one of the reasons why you're not seeing as many health effects, at least yet, with vaping in, say, the UK, is that the EU regulates vaping machines and the United States does not, in terms of the amount of nicotine involved. And so there was an article, I believe it was in The Guardian a few days ago, pointing out that, part of the reason why you've seen more of this in the United States than here is because it's actually a different product. Yeah.
So post-Brexit, we can look forward to Britain
freedom
a vaping paradise like the United States, where people can really
vape whatever it is they
can
want.
Really vape their heads off.
Well, that's freedom for you or something.
Well, we're hypocrites because, of course, this is called the Whiskey Rebellion, and you and I have been known to go to the pub and occasionally drink whiskey. So
yes.
People have their own vices, but get
away. And some of us have more than others.
Indeed. Right.
All right, on that note, what's your last draft?
Well, I have two, actually, David. One is I want to endorse the Twitter feed that many of our colleagues or many of our listeners probably know about, which is by Carrie Lee Merritt, who's a historian
to you,
of course. She's great on Twitter. Do you know her? I've never met her.
I've never met her, but I've corresponded with her a number of times. I've assigned her book in class for several years.
Well, she had a very good thread on all of this yesterday and produced a wonderful advertisement from the 19th century I think it was called Cocoa Rats. It was a cocaine cigarette that was being marketed to American women. And Dr. Merritt made the point that people in the 19th century were wasted all the time.
Yes.
Between alcohol consumption, laudanum,
cocaine.
The cocaine, Coca-Cola used to have cocaine. And it just reminded me of how good her Twitter feed is. But that thread in particular was very good. So please find Carrie Lee Merritt. And the second thing I want to do is just promote ourselves, which is you and I are doing a live episode in November, on November 22nd, I think it is. We'll circulate details closer to the time as part of the Edinburgh History Festival. So we're going to do a live event in town, and we'd love as many local listeners who would like to turn up. And as I said, we'll circulate the details when we have them in terms of the venue and the time and so on. But
We're hoping to do a bunch of live events over the next couple of years because I really enjoy our live shows.
Yes, I agree. What's your last drop, David?
So I want to endorse a book that's coming out soon that's actually related to our topic today. It's by Sarah Myloff. It's called The Cigarette, A Political History. It's coming out from Harvard University Press on October 2nd. And I haven't read it yet because the book hasn't come out yet, but it's been getting some really good advanced press. And it has one of the best book covers I've ever seen, for at least better than academic books. It looks like the front of a pack of Marlboros. I'll post a picture of the book cover. But if the contents of the book are as good as the book cover, it's going to be really an extraordinary text and one that's obviously quite relevant.
Well, I welcome that, and I think I would endorse your endorsement. Although, David, surely you know not to judge a book by its cover.
Yeah, but it doesn't hurt, right?
It doesn't hurt.
Best part of my books are usually the cover. Anyway, till next time, Frank.
Okay, cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.